No man is an island, entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less. As well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
Welcome, fellow plebs. My name is Sean, and this is
Tribunus Plebis.
All right, everybody, welcome to episode number 13. The big news this week is Ruth Bader Ginsburg has passed away. Obviously, anybody dying is sad and worthy of mourning, but this death carries with it a distinct sense of awfulness for a lot of people, and, sadly enough, a deep sense of opportunity for many others. Donald Trump will now get to see another Supreme Court justice, and yes, this does matter. Ruth Bader Ginsburg wasn't right about everything she ruled on, or everything she spoke on, but she was, as far as the Supreme Court goes, one of the better justices to come along. She was correct often enough to stand out from the pack a little bit. And she will be replaced by somebody who is worse than she is, guaranteed. Even if the Democrats were able and willing to prevent Trump from sitting a justice and Biden were to win the upcoming presidential election, even he would sit a justice to Ginsburg's political right. He's too conservative and too cowardly to pick a truly progressive candidate. This is the guy who helped sit uber-conservative Justice Clarence Thomas and passively allowed Anita Hill's character to be assassinated on live television. But the reality is that Trump and McConnell will sit an ultra-conservative justice on the Supreme Court, and this justice will be young, ideologically locked in, and most likely a white person, if we're being honest. And I don't want to depress anybody, but this new justice will have the same dark, malignant hole in their soul that these other conservative justices have as well. These aren't good people. And this country will be worse off for that. In fact, the country will be directly harmed by it. And I want to disabuse those of you who are optimistic here. Trump will sit this new justice. It will do you and us absolutely no good to scream about the hypocrisy of the Republican senators who will ignore the precedent that they set with the Merrick Garland situation under Obama. Just don't do it. You'll be wasting your breath. Ginsburg herself is supposed to have said that her final wish was that her seat not be filled until after the election. And that's a really nice thought that will fit well within the liberal meme groups, but nobody who matters, meaning the Republican senators, is going to give a single shit about that wish. And they shouldn't if we are being honest and accepting the fact that this is a game of politics and power. Sorry, but this is a done deal. We have to fight on other fields. Sure. Let Pelosi and Schumer pretend that they are appalled. Let Obama release a statement about how unfair it is or whatever. But always remember that Obama didn't do shit to push Garland through, and neither did the other Democrats. They just sat in their offices or guffawed for the cameras. They never actually did anything at all because they either don't understand politics and power, or they are too stupid to actually act on it, or they simply chose not to. Any of those three things are malpractice. Even if all political gambits would have failed in the end, they didn't even try. Are they fools, or are they complicit? And is that a distinction without a difference? I mean, listen, my day job is driving a tractor-trailer truck 60 hours a week, and I barely graduated high school. How the hell is it that I understand political power better than the Democratic leadership? That's sad. This is literally their only job, to amass political offices and power. and they don't fucking get it. That should embarrass them. That it does not embarrass them should lead us to ask ourselves why it wouldn't. If you can say one thing for the Republicans, you can say that they understand power and how to use it. I mean, they are evil pieces of garbage, please don't get me wrong, but they do understand how to get, hold, and use power. And here's the thing about the current election. Joe Biden's campaign has been run on two things. The first is that the orange man is worse than he is. The second thing is the potential to name a new Supreme Court justice. Well, this death just took that second lever away from him. The Supreme Court is lost for the rest of my life, and I am only 42. So what exactly is Joe Biden going to do to convince people to vote for him? Does he lean into the orange man bad narrative that failed in 2016 and probably won't work this time? He needs to do something that will actually get people who don't want to vote for him to vote for him. He needs to start running on packing the Supreme Court and also ending the filibuster. But he won't do that because he's weak, and both he and the Democrats either don't understand that power or they are complicit with it. This situation is highlighting the inherent negatives of running a presidential campaign based entirely on that guy is worse and think about the Supreme Court, rather than actually pushing good ideas and policy. And a lot of Biden people might say, but look at his website. It says this and that that you might agree with. Well, you know what? Go over there and tell Biden to run on some of that good shit, if it actually exists. Get out there and tell people why they should vote for him, not against Trump. We have a guy running for president who refuses to go out and give us positive reasons to vote for him. It's just that the other guy is worse than he is. Don't blame the voters if he loses. This was all very predictable. I even wrote an article about it way back in January for the blog. This really isn't hard stuff, guys. If you want to try to figure this stuff out, just always assume that none of these politicians care about any of us, and that they are actually trying to directly harm us. It leads you to the correct assessment of any particular situation far more often than is really comfortable to talk about. Okay, all that said, let's hit the meat of the episode here. Today I want to talk about the prevalence of the bootstrap mythology and the constant refrain of personal choices to solve deeply complex, systemic issues in this country and how it harms the working class. The first thing I want to address is the term bootstrap itself. And yes, this might be a little pedantic and probably unnecessary, but I find it interesting anyway, so you're going to have to bear with me for a brief moment. When I was young, this idea of pull yourself up by your bootstrap, it really confused me. It didn't make much sense to me, but old people kept saying it, and I knew what they meant by it through context, so I just figured I somehow didn't understand what was being said. And it turns out I was right all along, at least in a certain sense. The term pull yourself up by your bootstrap was originally used to describe a situation of impossibility, because it is, indeed, impossible to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. That's what it meant in the early 1800s in its first recorded uses. It wasn't until the mid-20th century that this metaphor had changed to mean something like help yourself or self-determination, rather than hopeless attempts at an impossible feat. It had changed to mean self-starting and to succeed on your own. And most Americans seem to believe this myth of the bootstraps. A 2011 Pew Research survey asked respondents this question. Which of the following young people is more likely to get ahead economically? Young person A grew up in a poor neighborhood. Young person A has the drive and ambition to get ahead. Or, young person B grew up in a wealthy neighborhood. Young person B lacks drive and ambition. In other words, who is more likely to succeed financially? A child in a poor neighborhood with drive, person A, or a lazy rich kid, person B? Now, 69% of respondents said person A, the poor kid, strongly. 9% said person A, not so strongly. On the other side, 11% said person B strongly, and 5% said person B not so strongly. So 78% of those who responded to this survey said that the poor young person with drive and ambition was more likely than the lazy rich kid to get ahead economically, versus just 16% who thought the lazy rich kid would succeed. This is absolutely comical. Oh, and it's also extremely, unequivocally wrong. It is far, far more likely that any lazy rich kid will end up at the top of the wealth pyramid than any poor, driven kid. That's just the reality that we live in. And for anyone out there thinking, well, what about insert famous person who came from nothing's name here? You are right, a poor, underprivileged human being can come up. Nobody is saying that it's impossible. But here are a few things to consider. Two-thirds of those born at the top of the pyramid stay there as adults. 23% of poor whites will remain at the bottom fifth of the income scale, and 16% will reach the top fifth. And remember, we are talking fifths here, not extreme wealth. For poor blacks, the numbers are far more stark. 50% of those born into poverty will remain there, and only about 3% will hit the top fifth of the scale. Poverty, much like wealth, is inherited. Poverty, much like wealth, is generational. And poverty, as it relates to these broad racial categories, is created through systemic actions and choices. These facts spit directly into the face of the idea that poverty and being poor is an individual issue. It's not. It is a systemic issue from tip to tail, regardless of whatever outliers we might identify along the way. Your starting position matters. Parents matter. Education matters. Healthcare matters. Even neighborhoods matter. Poor children are sent to subpar schools. Their parents are more likely to be uneducated. Their neighborhoods are far less likely to provide good jobs, access to information, think libraries, after-school programs, bookstores, and even high-speed internet access. And they have far fewer avenues to success that are sometimes much murkier and harder to define than these things. Wealthier families and wealthier neighborhoods have more access to better versions of all of those things. Libraries, after-school programs, daycare, bookstores, and high-speed internet, to name a few. They also have access to things which are more intangible. Things like internships, interpersonal connections with successful people, and knowledge of how to navigate complicated social, educational, and labor situations and systems. How many poor kids can accept year-long internships with little or no pay, even if they have managed to get as far as being offered one? Now think about how many wealthy people can accept them. And so far, I have danced around only one situation: the economic issues that help divide and keep apart the different classes in this country, the wealth gap. It's something that is on a lot of people's minds lately, this divide between the poor and the ultra-wealthy, and it should be too. It is debilitating to society to have such a massive gap within it. Now, I just want to take a second here because I want you to understand that this episode is not about the wealth gap or any other example that I might bring up along the way. It's about systemic problems and the false premise that personal choices can fix those problems. Now, one of the things that really prompted me to tackle this subject now instead of later like I planned was a recent episode of the Joe Rogan Experience that featured everybody's favorite smooth-brained cornball, Ben Shapiro. In this episode, Shapiro talked about the homeless problem in Los Angeles. He started out by saying that as he walked to work and saw these homeless people, that while it sucked, it wasn't so bad because he didn't see them where he lived. Out of sight, out of mind for old Benji, I guess. But then he started to talk about homelessness as these individual failures. And he talks about how those born into ghettoized projects in underfunded sections of massively wealthy cities just need to make better choices. He claims that America cannot be a systemically racist country because there is no law requiring segregation or supporting racism outright. He says that racism is, in fact, illegal. Therefore, this country cannot be systemically racist. And he is wrong, and also kind of an asshole. I can't believe this dork has millions of listeners. It kind of depresses me. To make these claims is to ignore history. And I want to be fair here. Shapiro did make a line between historical issues and current decisions, but he's largely wrong to do so. And to do so is to ignore slavery, black code laws which restricted the freedom of newly freed slaves and basically made it illegal to exist as a black person in this country, and were enforced at the whim of the local police in a form of brutal terrorism. It ignores segregation and Jim Crow. It ignored voting laws and poll taxes. People who think like Shapiro, meaning people who can't actually think, believe that racism, especially in a systemic nature, magically disappeared after the Civil Rights Act. It didn't. The casual racism of entire regions continued, this time as winks and nods that kept blacks segregated as much as possible. Such shabby, so-called logic ignores things like real estate redlining, which lasted well into the 1970s, and which prevented blacks from owning homes and renting apartments in certain areas. This affected familial wealth and stability for generations afterwards, especially the buying of homes, which is one of the great wealth accumulators generation over generation that exists. It ignores the construction of the interstate highway system, which refused to place profit-generating on- and off-ramps in predominantly black neighborhoods and instead placed them in white enclaves or simply pushed them out into the new white flight suburbs. Such straight-up dumb shit ignores the drug war, which was designed to harm black communities and is disproportionately used to attack that same community even today. Ben strikes me as the sort of person who would watch all 6 or 7 seasons of The Wire and wonder why none of those kids chose to go to Harvard. You have to be a straight-up fool to believe that Shapiro's correct here. And Joe Rogan needs to stop bobbleheading along with these absolute ghouls and say something of substance. He has a massive audience, and that audience trusts him. And when such stupidity and ignorance goes unchallenged, it lends both general weight to the argument and it signifies agreement. The now iconic pleading of, "Don't listen to me, I'm just a meathead comedian who talks about fighting," just isn't good enough at this level. And just to be fair to Joe in this particular instance, he actually did a reasonably good job of pushing back on Shapiro in this particular episode. So I don't want to just crush Joe specifically here on this issue. He just needs to be better all around, in my opinion. He might not like it and slough it off, but his show is extremely influential and, in my opinion, he should take that more seriously. And as to the homeless quote-unquote problem, that's a systems issue as well. It cannot and will not be fixed by individual action. Have any of you looked at the cost of housing in these places where homelessness is an quote-unquote issue? It's absolutely insane. This is a systems problem. Sorry, everybody, but we need to do better than this. We need to expand our thinking to broader systems, not the individual outputs. When we take a systemic problem and we minimize the systemic issues and rhetorically transmute them into personal failings, we cause several problems all at once. The first is that we begin telling people who are struggling that their struggle is their own fault. We incept into these people's psyches this deeply poisonous notion that they have failed themselves and their families, and that this is all due to their own choices and actions. We insist that they, that ever-present other that we love to throw around, that they, those losers, just didn't work hard enough. That they didn't make the correct choices. That they, in the end, just didn't work hard enough. And after a while, this begins to set in. The poor and disenfranchised begin to actually internalize the notion that they are the problem, and they begin to actually believe it. And once that internalizing has congealed and set, it lines up with the narrative of those who did get ahead, that the successful just work hard and the poor are simply lazy. And once this narrative, this false narrative, takes hold, we stop looking for systemic fixes. After all, it's not the system's fault. The poor are just lazy. They should work harder. Clean your room, save more, stop eating avocados, and all that other nonsense. By pushing these individualistic narratives, we compound the problem in a few ways. One is that we suffer from survivorship bias as we read these stories. Like I mentioned before, I'm sure we all know some celebrity or maybe a friend with a hard luck to gold story. I'm sure we've all heard that mailroom to CEO story as well. That's all well and good, but what about the millions of others? These individual stories don't really mean much in the grand scheme of things. We need to be aware that this anecdotal nonsense is being smuggled in under the guise of it being important data. It isn't. When we hear these plucky, try-hard stories being passed off as actual paths toward real solutions, we have to remember two things. The first is that these stories are 100% survivor-biased. Every single time you read about that CEO who started in the mailroom, remember that hundreds of other people started in that mailroom as well. And none of them ever became a CEO. 99% probably never even left that mailroom. When we hear about a man who grew up in a trailer park in Oklahoma and then went on to do this or that great thing, remember that millions of others lived and died in similar trailer parks all across the country. And don't give me this shit about how that guy must have worked harder than these other millions either. You know that's bullshit. No matter how many of these underdog done good stories we hear or read, any particular individualistic solution can only do one thing. It can only help a single individual. And while that is obviously good for that one person and the relative few who actually quote unquote make it, what of the other millions who didn't make it? Most of them through no fault of their own. We should be trying to help as many people as possible through systemic fixes, not telling people to clean their room. Another thing that happens to us is that by focusing so hard on the personal and individual level, we consistently fail to even look for systemic solutions to these systemic problems. Not only that, but we tend to actively fight against systemic solutions on the rare occasions when they are actually talked about. Again, we insist that there is no structural issue. The poor people just aren't working hard enough. They aren't making the correct decisions. They aren't working hard enough. They don't want it. They aren't cleaning their rooms and shit. Large systemic issues demand real systemic solutions. If a problem is systemic, then that problem is too big and too important for us to continue to ignore or slough off as a result of individual choices and lack of effort of those left behind. Is the problem here that we just can't recognize that a problem is systemic? I do think that this is at least a good chunk of our issue. It is very hard to think systemically. It takes a lot of bandwidth and imagination, and it's not that any of us lack the bandwidth or imagination, it's just that we either aren't used to using it, or that life in general is just chewing us up so thoroughly that it's impossible to carve out the time and effort to really apply these things. And let's not forget about the pervasiveness of this toxic narrative either. It really creeps into our brains and nests there. We just don't think about systemic solutions when we reduce all problems, no matter how broad or societal that they are, to individual choices. If it's always the individual's fault, we just passively accept that there is no bigger issue to look for. Another question that I think is important to dig into is this. Why are we so accepting of pushing this stuff onto the individual in the first place? We all tend to recognize that these problems are indeed systemic. That's why we bitch about politicians and their choices. All of these systemic issues are direct results of choices. Actual choices that actually affect the system. Whether framed as politics or policy or whatever else, these are conscious choices. These things are not some form of natural law. They are choices which are created by, made by, affect, and are propped up by, yes, systems again, not individualistic choice. And no individual choice can fix that. Declining wages? Systemic. The system is killing unions, fracturing the workplace, and pushing anti-worker bullshit like the gig economy. The housing market crash and resulting recession? It's systemic. The system deregulated the banks, and the banks used that system to defraud tens of thousands of borrowers and created the market crash out of pure greed and malfeasance. Then the system they bought with lobby money bailed them out. Are shitty healthcare and private insurance corruption? Systemic. The system lets insurance companies and hospitals financially destroy our lives if we get sick. Policy, legal, regulatory, and political problems? All systemic. And if our response from the left to the problem of stagnant and declining wages is to say, get another job, or get a second job, or be more thrifty, then we have failed ourselves and each other. We are telling people that it's okay that one full-time job is not enough and that a second job is the solution. We are saying that a higher minimum wage or holding horrific oppressive corporations like Uber and Lyft to the same labor standards as other employers is just too hard. It's too much work. Just deal with the inequity and grind yourself into dust instead. We are saying, work more, work harder, get less. Fuck you, get a third job, you lazy bastard. Why aren't you wealthy yet? It must be your own fault. Get a fourth job if you really want food. We are passing off the hard work of change to the individual them, not the collective us. We are witnessing systemic problems that are bogging down millions of Americans, and instead of doing the collective work as a broader community, we are instead pushing all of that work onto the individuals. These problems will not be solved like this. We can even consider something as widespread as pollution. We are told that the way to fix this is by recycling our cans and bottles or buying hybrid cars. Meanwhile, in setting aside the bullshit that recycling is, the massive plastics producers of the world have the vast majority of pollution coming directly from them. Sure, go ahead and recycle that soup can or the soda bottle, but remember that the plastic plant down by the river is spewing thousands of tons of microplastics and toxic waste directly into your water supply with the distinct okay of your government. Those expensive reusable water bottles don't amount to an anthill in comparison. That is a systemic issue. Just 100 companies are responsible for 71% of the greenhouse gases being spewed into the air. Just 20% represent 35% of the global emissions. So basically, if every single person was 100% responsible and perfect and did absolutely everything correctly, at a higher monetary cost, by the way, let's not forget that part, then we could possibly reduce greenhouse gases by just 29%. Now, that's not a small number for sure. I get it. But the problem here is systemic. The problem is far bigger than individuals. But yeah, go get a hybrid. That'll fix everything. Another analogy I found while trying to think this through is medicine in the human body. The individualistic approach is maybe akin to treating symptoms rather than the disease, or maybe hacking at branches rather than the root. If somebody has a severely debilitating disease and we just tell them to take an expensive painkiller so that they can work a second job to afford those pills, we haven't really fixed anything. The problem is systemic. This person's organs are failing, and we are giving them pain pills when some other more difficult and complicated treatment is available to cure that disease. Or maybe this sickness is affecting millions of people systemically, and we understand the cause, maybe it's poor nutrition. So what do? We tell people, especially and most cruelly, poor people in food deserts, to go eat more kale or something. Eat steak and expensive cruciferous greens and whatnot. Foods which these people would struggle to find, let alone afford. So yeah, we can put all of that on the individual. We could. Or, and hear me out here for just a second, we could tell these evil fucking corporations to stop poisoning everybody with their toxic bullshit and maybe flay these immoral asshole CEOs in the public square. Or even just sue them maybe, or put them in prison for poisoning and harming people, I don't know. But we should definitely do something, right? Something that actually matters, maybe. And listen, none of this is to completely absolve each of us of any responsibilities we may have in our lives. We should brush our teeth and not harm other people. We should be held accountable for our actions as well. Of course, this caveat shouldn't have been needed, but I know you people. I had to say that. But we shouldn't pretend like these personal band-aids are truly fixing the overarching problems. One of the things that the bootstrap and individual solutions people do is frame what they are saying and suggesting that it is some sort of motivational narrative. It's very self-help at its core. And the best of these folks really do consider this stuff inspirational. They view it as a path to betterment and entirely uplifting. But what it becomes in the real world is blame. And when we blame, we fail to learn. We fail to be curious. We cast blame on those that failed to thrive, and by doing so, we ourselves have decided not to inquire into the health or functionality of the system. We only want to blame those affected by it. If we blame like this, then we immediately begin to fail to look into, let alone understand, the actual problem. After all, once again, if it's all the individual's fault, then why look any broader or deeper? There is no need to look deeper if it's always the end user's fault. We blame the leaves of the tree for not thriving while we neglect the blighted roots. When we encounter a massive problem that affects millions, and we just sit back and point and say, well, the fault lies with each and every one of you, we are casting blame. And when we cast this blame, this distribution of faults as it is, we are, in effect, shaming. We are telling all of those affected that there is something wrong with them. They're lazy, they're stupid, they don't work hard enough, they just don't want it badly enough. And this doesn't just affect the targets in negative ways either. It actually affects those who cast the aspersions as well. The blamed begin to internalize those messages about laziness, criminality, or lack of fortitude, while the blamers begin to internalize things like self-righteousness, judgment, and a false sense of superiority, which they are more than happy to wield at the drop of a hat. This is not how we solve problems. It's how we allow problems to thrive. By blaming, we shift the burden. We shift the burden from systemic structural inequality and failings, and we pass it to the individual. The worst people who use this tactic of blame are those who are directly and knowingly refusing to address systemic problems and the changes these systems need. They use blame to redirect the anger of the masses. They say things like, oh look, a lazy poor person in a minority neighborhood got something for free. Aren't you angry that this lazy poor person in a minority neighborhood got something for free, old, hard-working white guy in a white neighborhood? Trust me, the powers that be do not want us angry at the system. That's why they blow these sorts of dog whistles nonstop, 24/7, 365. Harry Truman once said, quote, I'll tell you what's at the bottom of it. If you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down to and he'll empty his pockets for you. End quote. I know that's not a perfect quote for this situation, but I think it works. And we can even take out the race part of it, although we probably shouldn't, and we can see how this can fit into a lot of our current situations. Those who hold power understand how tenuous that grip actually is. They understand how unfair, brutal, and oppressive the current systems are. They also understand that we, the people, have the ability to force those in power to change these systems or even to just do it ourselves. This is why they dog whistle. This is why they act like there is this great divide, and then they work together to further cement their power and debase ours. This is why they keep creating enemies for us to fear, despise, and hate. Stop falling for it. Stop blaming the victims. None of this is going to help us. We need to begin actually fixing the system.